Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. Well, the career ladder, as we once knew it, is a thing of the past, yet many don't understand how to navigate the frequent and often necessary career changes that today's business world demands. You know, the average employee tenure in America is now only 4 to 5 years, which surprised me. And during that time, most employees have several shifting roles. That means if we're not changing the way we think about job roles, professional goals and personal growth, we're getting left behind. We're being acted upon instead of taking action and choosing. And my second guest today, Jenny Blake, has written a book called Pivot. The only move that matters is your next one. She's a former Google career strategist, now self-employed, and she'll talk to us about that in the second half. But first, I'm very pleased to welcome Linda Kahanoff to the show. She's written a great book. It's called The Five Roles of a Master Herder, a revolutionary model for socially intelligent leadership. And let me tell you a little bit about Linda. She's written several books. She's a teacher. She's an author, a speaker. And she's explored the way of the horse, an experiential wisdom gained by studying the non-predatory power of horses. That's what this book is about. And she adapts those horse-inspired insights into useful tools for developing collaborative leadership and managing change. And she's the author of The Tao of Equus. And she established Eponequest. I have to ask Linda how she says this. Eponequest Worldwide to explore the healing potential of working with horses and offering programs on everything from emotional and social intelligence, leadership, stress reduction, and parenting. And I'd like to bring her on right now, Linda Kahanoff.
It's
welcome.
Great to be here, Vicki. Thank you.
How are you? How do you pronounce that, the name of your company?
Eponequest. You got it right.
Eponequest. Okay. I had a little typo there, and so it didn't help the matter when I was trying to pronounce it. My typo, not yours. But so I want to talk a little bit about this book is called The Five Roles of a Master Herder. I know you've had a very interesting background. You spent a great deal of time as a program director in public radio. You've worked for profit and nonprofit organizations. You're also very, very, very experienced with horses, too. And I want to just begin with, what is a master herder?
When I was writing my fourth book, which is The Power of the Herd, the book that came right out before this one, I was researching the history of leadership through multiple cultures. And I found out, first of all, that a lot of our most innovative leaders throughout history were exceptional horsemen. And that includes George Washington, it includes the Buddha, it includes Catherine the Great, Winston Churchill, even Ronald Reagan, and that they were learning a lot of really sophisticated leadership skills working with large, powerful animals and actually motivating these animals who are herbivores, they're not carnivores, horses, they could actually motivate these animals to override their most basic survival instincts to do wild things like go into a bloody war and even receive exceptional medals for bravery. And that their ability to do this with these animals translated into their ability to do this with large populations of people. And along the way, I came across herding cultures, and by herding I mean, you know, moving herds of large, powerful, unrestrained animals.
Right.
We would call them nomadic pastoral cultures. And I began to see that they used five roles interchangeably to be able to pull this off, because these people have to move large animals without restraint and without fences over vast distances through changing climates, keeping the herd and the tribe together, whether they were moving toward greener pastures or fighting off predators. And it's very hard to pull off something like that unless you have a really sophisticated, socially intelligent understanding of leadership. And I was able, through these various studies and also experiences teaching people leadership skills through working with horses over the years, that I was able to see that they differentiate, first of all, between the role of the dominant and the role of leader. Because they learned this from the animals themselves. Among horses and cattle, the leader animal and the dominant animal are often two different animals, and they perform specific types of interventions with the herd that leads to the well-being of the entire herd. But they also engage in sentinel activities where they watch over the herd in relation to threats and opportunities in the environment. And they keep the herd together through a large amount of time spent in the nurturing and companionship role, and that in itself is a form of power to develop loyalty and trust. And master herders in these cultures learned how to use all of these roles because they were able to separate it from predatory behavior.
Mm.
So they learned that you can use the dominant role without combining it with the predator role.
Right.
And the leader role and all of the others. And if they hadn't have learned to do this, large unrestrained animals would have simply run off. And so these days, in our culture that is a sedentary culture, we've lost a lot of this knowledge. But our hierarchical command-control culture is shifting because all the old fences have fallen down. We have more freedom than ever, and so we have to learn how to bring quote-unquote herds or tribes of empowered, free people together to perform ambitious goals.
So let's talk a little bit about the horse itself, because I love horses. With dogs, they're right up there. I just love horses. A lot of people think they're prey animals, but they're not. You say that they can be predatory and non-dominant or dominant. So tell us.
Well, yeah. So, actually, it's more accurate to say that they're non-predatory power animals.
Yes.
Sometimes they can be prey, but a lot of times they're highly successful in fighting off predators. And a lot of predators are smart in that they won't attack, especially groups of mature horses, because they're going to lose. And so just because you're not a predator doesn't mean you're not powerful. And so horses teach you how to be powerful without being a predator.
Right. And you say in the book that learning to share power is the challenge of the 21st century. And boy, are we seeing that in this election right
now. Oh, my
now.
Goodness.
I mean, if, you know, we took a lesson from the horses here, maybe we wouldn't be all suffering this terrible farce right now. But the book itself looks at history, it looks at animal behavior, science, religion, cultural, political challenges from this perspective of non-predatory power. So so tell me what it is about the horse that is so special, because there's a lot of animals out there who have, you know, they have their own animal patterns. Why the horse?
Well, they're very social. And they're also very confident, and they work together to protect vulnerable members of the herd. They're very courageous, and they're very adaptable. Because, you know, technically speaking, a large herbivore that has evolved to move on open plains in the Eurasian steppes, which is where they appear to show up, as well as, you know, some evidence that they started off in the large plains of the United States, they shouldn't get, if they weren't able to override their basic survival instincts, they would never have gotten on a ship and been able to come to America, for instance. They would never go near the scent of blood if they weren't able to override their basic survival instincts. And they're incredibly loyal. And if you become a member of their herd, they will protect you.
Right.
And so I've been out, you know, in the desert with my horse. I had a horse named Rasa who I spent a lot of time with. And I used to go for walks in the desert with her. She had become lame and couldn't be ridden. And if any animals came up, I would be shocked that she would step out in front and protect me. And most people would think that, you know, a large herbivore, if they were really only identified as a prey animal, that they would have just run screaming in the other direction and left me to be faced with whatever predator was coming out of the grass.
Right.
So you know, they really do model a way of being powerful in the world without being predatory.
Right.
And they show us, when you look at a variety of behavior patterns that they have, that they there are ways of being powerful together with others rather than having power over others. And there are ways of fighting against predators without becoming a predator yourself.
And so the five, and I agree with you on, I've been in a situation with my horse that I had as a teenager, all my teenage years, where I was trying to protect him from a blizzard. I was leading him down to the stables, and I was trying to protect his head and his eyes, because their eyes are so open, from this blizzard, which was literally just cutting across with gale force winds. And he kept nudging around the other side of me, trying to protect me from it. So I totally get that.
Yeah, it's really quite amazing what they're capable of doing. And people used to think they were stupid. I've seen many old television shows that talked about how stupid horses were, and they're actually extremely intelligent.
They are.
And there's much research now that actually does confirm that.
Right. So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk about learning to share that power in a balanced way, because that's a huge focus of the book. And I want to talk about a couple of the 12 guiding principles that you also share in the book. And my guest is Linda Kahanoff. The book is called The Five Roles of a Master Herder, a Revolutionary Model for Socially Intelligent Leadership. Please stay with us. We'll be right back.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
It's me, your heart. High blood pressure is serious, and if you think I'm just going to keep ticking away, you're wrong. I can quit whenever I want, but I like my job. Just treat me better. Maybe we can do some exercise on occasion? After all, we're in this together.
Don't let your heart quit on you. High blood pressure can lead to a stroke, heart attack, or death. Get yours to a healthy range before it's too late. For help keeping yours at a healthy range, text PRESSURE to 97779. A message from the American Heart Association, the American Stroke Association, and the Ad Council.
Coming up next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, award-winning journalist Jessica Bennett takes a timely, often hilarious, but always solution-oriented look at sexism in today's workplace. Part manual, part manifesto, Feminist Fight Club tells how women in New York formed a secret club without men and without fighting to combat sexism and redefine sexist archetypes. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific Time right here on Alternative Talk 1150. Listen online at 1150kknw.com.
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, bringing you guests ranging from authors and filmmakers to explorers and dream makers.
Talk radio with a purpose. Alternative Talk 1150.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. My guest is Linda Kahanoff and her book, The Five Roles of a Master Herder. And it's a revolutionary model for socially intelligent leadership. And I think this applies to all aspects of life. Would you not agree, Linda?
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're not just talking business here. We're talking all aspects of life. And I want to ask you, I don't want to go into the politics. I think we've all had enough of this. But we've certainly seen struggles for power and the way that people handle that search for power. And you talk a lot in the book about learning to share power in a balanced way. And we all need really a balance of these five roles of a master herder to be really successful. So I wonder if you can talk to us about the balance of power and how that's important to us.
Yes, well, as it turns out, you really need to use all five roles and understand the differences between them and when and how to use them in their mature forms, because all of them have an immature form that can be highly dysfunctional. And so we see a lot of immature dominance behavior in the corporate world and in politics. And I wrote this book long before the current political election that's coming up. And you can actually look at the dominant role and see that Donald Trump, for instance, overemphasizes the dominant role in its immature form. But the people are attracted to him because he has the qualities innate in him that would be able to be using the mature dominant role, which has a protective capability and a directive capability.
Mm-hmm.
He also overemphasizes the predator role and combines those two. And a lot of people see that as power, but it's an imbalanced use of power, and we need to really recognize that the dominant role is different than the role of leader, and that even in herds of horses, the dominant animal and the leader animal are often two different animals. And so the leader role is the one that gets out in front of the herd and inspires and looks at opportunities on the horizon, and in human terms is often involved in innovation. And the nurturer companion role is the role that has incredible power to create loyalty and trust. But that role can be misused. If somebody overemphasizes the nurturer companion role, they'll actually start engaging in passive-aggressive power plays, and they can be very toxic to an organization. So we might see dominant and predator behavior misused, and it can be really flamboyant and intimidating. But the misuse of the nurturer companion role, we see a lot, and we see a lot of behind-the-scenes power plays and manipulation that leads to toxic behavior in groups. And a lot of people just completely ignore the sentinel role, and the sentinel role is where you step back away from the business or the herd or the tribe or the family, and you look at the group in relation to threats and opportunities in the environment. And it seems like somehow we've almost lost the ability to use that role, but you need to have that role as well. And sometimes you may need to use the predator role. When it's used well, the predator role is like in any ecosystem. It keeps life in balance with the available resources. So that if the economic climate changes, you might need to bring forth your inner lion or your inner predator to make thoughtful decisions about what programs to cut and how to appropriately lay people off in order to allow the organization to survive long term. But the predator role should always be used thoughtfully and without anger or resentment, or it becomes like a rabid carnivore or a rabid dog running loose in a junkyard or something.
Right, right.
So all five roles are needed, and we hardly ever see a leader that has access to all five roles. And yet it's really not that hard to develop all five roles. Once you recognize when and how you use them, it's really changed people's lives internationally to very quickly learn when and how to use up all five roles. And suddenly, when you have groups of empowered people who also know how to use all five roles, the entire intelligence and creativity and effectiveness of the organization suddenly uplifts.
Yeah. You have a great tool at the back for analyzing our leadership style. And I did run through that. It was very interesting to help us become better leaders. Since you mentioned the Trump, we have to also mention Hillary Clinton. So
yes.
Where would you put her in this, in the five roles?
Well, I would say that she has more of a balanced ability with several of the roles. She doesn't seem to be good at the sentinel role. She needs to pick up on that one a little bit. And she because she was taught to be an attorney, she has access to the dominant role, but sometimes she doesn't use it so well. But I think that she has some real orientation toward the leader role and the nurturer companion role. And she's grown up in a highly predatory environment. And so her response to being in a really predatory environment is to become more secretive. Donald Trump's response is to become more aggressive. But to me, there's two sides of the same dysfunctional coin that occurs when you live in an overly predatory culture where you have to be constantly on guard and you cannot show any vulnerability or make any mistakes without people going for the throat.
Right, right. Well, you shared 12 guiding principles. I want to look at a couple of those if we can. Discover and inspire leadership through relationship. And the role here is leader. So you share a story about three young mares that you adopted. I wonder if you'd share that with us.
Yes, I actually have three mares. I call them the Spice Girls because they're all uniquely beautiful in their own way. And they're a really great example of a herd where each horse tends to specialize in one role, and you really get to see how these roles stand out. But one of the horses, Savannah, she's the littlest one of all, but she's like a little Napoleon. She overemphasizes the dominant role. She pushes others around, and one of the things that an immature dominant will do is attack other horses for little or no reason in order to keep everyone a bit on edge. So when we see dominant bosses or dominant politicians suddenly attacking people for little or no reason, that's an instinctual behavior that immature dominant horses engage in, purely instinctual. It's just designed to keep everybody a little bit on edge so that the dominant can take control. However, it's really, and a lot of times we see the dominant behavior in horses and we think that's the leader. But the leader actually, the leader horse emerges when there's a novel situation, when something new comes into the environment. And so we see Savannah acting out in a dominant way. And then we put some new fences into their corral in order to set up a certain area there. And naturally what happened was Savannah herded everyone away from the new thing, wanted to keep everyone safe, and is very reticent against new things coming into the environment. That is generally what the dominant does, protect the herd. But then after a few minutes, another horse named Layla, who's really beautiful, she's a paint horse with two blue eyes, she actually came out of the herd and started to walk with an appropriate yet short-lived level of curiosity toward the new thing. And then she began to investigate the new thing. And then as a result of her investigating the new thing, her curiosity and her confidence were contagious, and the rest of the herd came over. And as a result of other horses following Layla, Savannah gave Layla a really hard time at the end of the day. The dominant felt like she had to attack the leader because the leader suddenly had the attention of others. And Savannah even came over and followed the leader in spite of herself. so you often see this behavior. Somebody who has a really good innovative idea in a business situation, others follow it and become enthusiastic, and then the most dominant member of the team will kind of try to take that person down or kind of punish them or dress them down over something at the end of the day. Have you seen that behavior before?
Oh, I've certainly experienced that behavior, yes.
Exactly. And we all think, oh, it's human and it's so personal, but it's not personal. It's instinctual dynamics that we can learn to manage.
Yeah.
And then there's one other horse in that herd. Her name is Brandy, and she's really the nurturer companion. So at the end of the day, when Savannah was chasing Layla away from food and water to punish her for acting in a leadership role, then Brandy came in between the two of them, and she spent some time connecting with Layla, and then she would go over and spend some time connecting with Savannah. And then over the course of an hour, she brought all three of them back together, and they stood around and engaged in a mutual grooming session. And so the conflict resolution happened because of the skills of this nurturer companion named Brandy.
Well, it's fascinating stuff. We have just a couple of minutes left here, so I wonder if we can just look very quickly at this other guiding principle, support and connect, the power of companionship. And this is the role of nurturer, which you said earlier, if we overdo it. All of these roles have shadow sides if we overdo it, so they can be negative. So can we talk a little about this in just a couple of minutes?
I think such a great example of the way this role is important and yet it's so profoundly ignored is a story of a sociometrist by the name of Greg Reed went into a pretty famous computer company, and HR, human resources, said they had two problems. First of all, the problem they wanted Greg to work with was a group known as the curmudgeons. And these were the guys that would hole up in their offices and leave, you know, right at 5 and have trouble communicating. But they were great programmers, and they had, you know, they would show high production and reach pretty significant production goals. And then HR said, there's another problem we have here, and her name is Melanie. And it turned out that Melanie was a programmer, but she wasn't able to get anywhere near the production goals set for her. And they were worried about her, and they were thinking they were going to have to fire her. And they told Greg, you know, we don't want to fire her because we're going to be very unpopular because everybody loves Melanie. So Greg did all of these interviews and measurements and found out that when the average person in that company left for vacation, there was about a 5% drop in productivity. When Melanie left, there was a 36% drop in productivity. So as it turned out, Melanie didn't have time to do her job because she was the go-to person. If somebody needed something or needed to find out who to go to, and Greg even said, you know, she's the kind of person that can speak geek and regular English. And so she just really knew how to connect with and bring people together and facilitate connections between multiple departments. And that is the role of a really exceptional person who has a gift for the nurturer companion role and how important they can be.
Well, I know you took 4 years to write this book. You did an extraordinary amount of research on it. I find it personally very fascinating because I love horses and I'm very interested in leadership too. What would you like to leave our listeners with today?
Well, I think that, you know, we are finally getting to the point where we have enough freedom and enough people have enough freedom to begin to learn how to be functional in that freedom. We became free when our democracy was created, but we still had this all the skills associated with a dominant submission paradigm. And so we've been sort of floundering around for the last 250 years, not really understanding how to be powerful together.
Right.
How do we uplift each other? And this book, I believe, has significant skills for being able to do just that.
Right. Well, I know that William Shatner agreed with you.
he
reviewed Linda's book. He said, an innovative and practical nature-based approach to leadership and life. This book is not just for corporate executives, parents, teachers, community organizers, film directors, and especially politicians would all benefit from learning these skills. So I thank you so much for being with us today, Linda Kahana. The book is called The 5 Roles of a Master Herder, a revolutionary model for socially intelligent leadership. I know you have a couple of different websites, so what's the best one for people to reach you at?
Well, the Master Herder website is going to go up in the next week or two. And so in the meantime, my IponaQuest.com leadership has the most information.
Great, IponaQuest.com. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Vicki.
And we'll be right back. We're going to take a quick break. Please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
2, 3. Well, my heart knows it better than I know myself, so I'm gonna let it do all the talking. I came across a place in the middle of nowhere with a big black horse and a cherry tree.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicki St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicki partners with people just like you at the exact level you need. Whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicki today. Email Vicki at VickiSt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicki and her work at VickiSt.Clair.com.
Looking for unconditional love, an exercise buddy, or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967, because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at paws.org or call 425-787-2500.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to Vicki Draper, the Healing Your Animal expert, we cover the world of animals. This week, October 23rd, it's Behavior Training and Healing and Anything You Want to Talk About Your Animals Sunday. As an animal behavior therapist and trainer, I'll take your calls and answer your questions and help you resolve any issues you've got going on with your animal friends. And you can call in about any animal-related topic you want to talk about. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
Working hard to put a smile on your face. Alternative Talk 1150.
Welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. We're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And my next guest is Jenny Blake. She's a career and business strategist and international speaker, and she helps people move beyond burnout and create sustainable careers that they love. We talked at the top of the hour how the average tenure of an American employee now is 4 to 5 years. That's not very long, so you've got to be doing some work there to keep up with things. And Jenny left her job in career development at Google in 2011 after 5.5 years to launch her first book, which was called Life After College. And since then, she's run her own consulting business. Jenny Blake, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. That statistic is really interesting. And what I found writing the book, I couldn't even keep up with people after a year. Almost everyone had I interviewed had pivoted by choice and by circumstance.
Oh, wow. Well, the book is called Pivot. The only move that matters is your next one. So Jenny knows a lot of people who've pivoted, right?
I do.
So let's just begin with your Google story, because you were at Google, you were successful there, you took a leave of absence, I think, and then had to decide, do I want to go back, do I not want to go back? So tell us about that and how that led to your own business.
Yeah, I had worked there 5.5 years in training and career development as the company grew from 6,000 to 36,000 employees. And I pivoted internally within the company. But as my first book was coming out in 2011, I had a perfect on paper job. I could not have crafted a better position for myself doing coaching and career development and helping with authors at Google. And still, I was starting to really burn out, and I'd been running a blog and writing a book on the side since 2005, and I was just getting really tired from trying to do both. So as you mentioned, I took a sabbatical to launch my first book and agonized over what the right thing to do was, and it felt crazy not to go back. You know, I joke that it was like breaking up with Brad Pitt. You really think you can do better than Google? Why on earth would I think to start a business? How could I possibly earn what I was earning and have the impact and the growth and the yoga classes and 3 meals a day? But something in me, I felt like it was now or never to give my own business a shot. And so I gave myself 6 months to try and make it, move to New York City, and not without hitting financial zero, but I am still here 5.5 years later.
And people thought you were crazy, right? I know they certainly did when I left my corporate job. They're like, you're crazy. You're going through midlife crisis. This is just a phase. But you weathered through that. But I've heard you talk about this, that you did hit a patch a couple of years ago. I think it was 2014, maybe, where you just questioned, did I do the right thing? You're running out of money. things aren't going quite the way you were expecting them to at that time. And, you know, here you are thinking, maybe I made a mistake and maybe I should go back into the corporate world.
I didn't know what to do. Yeah, I'd hit a pivot point or plateau. And again, at the time, I didn't have this language for it that's much more judgment neutral. It just felt like a crisis. And I had become known as the girl who left Google. So on all the podcasts, that's what people wanted to talk about. So while I was at the company, it felt like I was in Google's shadow. And then when I left, it was still all about Google. So I didn't know how to unhook myself from them and make my own way in the world. It was this really bizarre time. And that's kind of, I paused a lot of my coaching and consulting and business services to figure this out. But my bank account very quickly dwindled to the point where, like you said, I had to question, do I need to go get another job? Is the jig up? Am I really not cut out for entrepreneurship after all? And that's when I realized that the biggest mistake I was making was focusing on things too far outside of myself. And what makes a pivot is that it's not a 180. It's not a great, big, drastic leap or a leap of faith. It's actually what I came to understand, what got me out of my pickle. And I ended up earning 3 times the revenue by the end of the year using this approach, was doubling down on what was working. And even if it was only 10%, how could I look at who had already hired me, what I was already working, doing, what I was enjoying, and what success would look like a year from now? Then that started to guide my pivot and build me back bit by bit.
Yeah, it's a bit like when somebody has some really great strengths, and in management, often you're told, you know, people need to work on their weaknesses. I don't agree with that. So doubling down on your strengths, I like that a lot. So let's just be really clear about what pivot means for those who haven't read the book.
So I define a pivot as a methodical shift in a new related direction based on doubling down on what's already working. A lot of, in the business space, startups talk about pivoting. It's often plan B to save the business from collapse. So something, plan A failed, and now they have to pivot to save the business. But when it comes to our careers and our own businesses, pivot is often plan A. It's as much a product of our success as anything else. And the key to pivoting successfully and continuously is to look at what is working, just like you talked about in management, looking at the strengths, our values, our interests, where we're most in the zone, what kind of impact we want to have, and shifting very methodically and intentionally. And the key is a new related direction. So if I had quit Google to become a full-time yoga teacher, that would have been more of a 180, and I would have been taking on much greater risk.
Right, right. So this book, you say, it's not about shoving it to the man, as they say. It's not about succumbing to golden handcuffs. So tell us in your own words how you describe your book.
I don't place judgment on either one. I think there's so much, depending where you hang out on the internet, there's either stuff saying, quit your job, don't work for the man, go move to Southeast Asia, have a laptop and a coconut, and you're set. And then there's other stuff.
But be a millionaire first, right?
Yeah. And so while I don't recommend that everybody go quit tomorrow and start your own business, I also don't recommend staying put just because you have golden handcuffs. You have a good situation, but you're increasingly getting restless and bored, and maybe your body starts sending physical signals that it's time to make a change. Because if we don't choose change, we often get pivoted. Change happens to us, especially in the economy that we're in. So it's not a value judgment on should we be self-employed or work for someone else. It's about, given my current career portfolio, what's working? I call them high net growth individuals. Yes, money is important, but it's not everything. So high net growth individuals are asking, how can I learn and grow? What am I excited to explore in this coming year? And ultimately, how can I make the biggest impact? So I have a lot of coaching clients who come to me. They're very successful. They're C-level, chief strategy officer, chief engineering. They're very high up, and they'll often come to me for coaching because now it's legacy time. Whatever they've been doing the last 20 years, they don't feel is making quite the impact that they want, the legacy they want to leave behind. And so they'll pivot, again, as a product of their success, which is ready to have an even greater impact on their family and society and companies.
Right, right. You know, so many people I've heard say this, and I've been in this situation too, where you have a loose idea. You know where you want to end up, but you don't know how to get there. And one of the things you talk about in the book is not worrying about the hows so much, but getting really clear. And one of the things I really liked, I have a friend actually who's going through this right now, and he was talking about how, you know, he has this analysis by paralysis by analysis. He's overanalyzing everything. And so I shared this with him, and he really liked it too. And you talk about a good place to start is identify your happiness formula, because you want this grounded before you even start thinking about all the other stuff. Can we talk about the happiness, your happiness formula for a minute?
Pivots can gobble up a tremendous amount of our mental bandwidth because we're asking life's biggest questions. Who am I? What do I want? How do I earn a living? How do I provide for myself? What's next? I mean, these are massive questions. And it's very hard to do that and to think creatively about those things when we are feeling pinched in other areas, like we're sleep deprived or stressed at work or overloaded, or where just other things in our life, our kind of foundational elements, are out of place. So the happiness formula is about saying what I call the macro and micro elements help you feel calm and healthy and engaged, and that you have space to tackle the bigger pivot questions. And so part of happiness formula might be morning routines. It might be the environment that you live in, whether it's your apartment or house or broader city that you live in. It might be how much time you spend with friends, hobbies, physical exercise, how much sleep you get, what your evening rituals look like. But it's starting to really identify when I'm operating at my best, what ingredients are present, and how do I mix and match them in such a way that it opens up time and space and energy to think about the bigger pivot questions.
Yeah, that is so critical. Very good point. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I have a load more questions for you, Miss Jenny Blake.
Great, thank you.
Jenny's book is called Pivot. It's The Only Move That Matters Is Your Next One. And you're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. We'll be right back.
Hi. I found a toy dinosaur over on the playground by Smith Street. It had this phone number on it, and, well, I just wanted to make sure the dinosaur made it back to its little owner.
Yeah. Hi. I think I found your kid's stuffed animal near the swing set. Just want to call. I'm sure she misses it.
I know my son gets super attached to the smallest things, even a fire truck, and I'd be happy to drop it off. The toy was a little muddy, so I cleaned it up, and it's good to go whenever you're around.
When I found the little sippy cup, I just had to give you a call. It's for a kid, you know?
We'd do anything for kids. Yet 1 in 6 children in the U.S. struggle with hunger. Help end childhood hunger and give all of our kids the meals they need to grow. Learn how at feedingamerica.org. Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Coming up next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, award-winning journalist Jessica Bennett takes a timely, often hilarious, but always solution-oriented look at sexism in today's workplace. Part manual, part manifesto, Feminist Fight Club tells how women in New York formed a secret club without men and without fighting to combat sexism and redefine sexist archetypes. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific Time right here on Alternative Talk 1150. Listen online at 1150kknw.com.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, bringing you topics ranging from meditation to conservation, business and careers, to health and wealth.
Real people, real life, real radio. Alternative Talk 1150.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Jenny Blake is my guest. She's the co-creator of Google's Career Guru program, but she's also a career and business strategist, international speaker, and author. Her new book is called Pivot: The Only Move That Matters Is Your Next One. Jenny, I'm wondering if you're ever going to get away from the Google umbrella.
You know, here, per the Pivot Method, I kind of rejected it. I needed to distance it for, I needed to move out of my parents' house after, you know, like that kind of thing. And then now I've come back around and I still partner with them. And it's a joy to go back and get to train. I still do trainings for Career Guru and still work with them now. And so I've come back around. I just needed a little distance. But, you know, per the pivot method, I talk about doubling down on your strengths. And Google was a huge part of my strengths and my learning and how I was able to write this book. So I'm very, very grateful for them.
Yes. And I think that everything in life adds to, you know, develop who you are today and where you're standing today. So it's all good stuff. It's all good.
Absolutely.
So I want to talk about decision fatigue, also known, as I understand from your book, as ego depletion. You know, sometimes we're faced, we feel like we're caught between a rock and a hard place. And sometimes, as in my case, a couple of times that I can think of, I've had too many choices, which sounds fabulous, but, you know, it can also cause that paralysis and give you decision fatigue. And talk to us a little bit about that, if you would.
It's a really interesting phenomenon that, similar to what we talked about with happiness formula, our brains have a limited capacity for making clear, rational, resonant decisions throughout a given day. So it's a resource that can be depleted, just like willpower is a finite resource. Studies show that people at the grocery store, for lower income shoppers, they are more susceptible to last minute purchases at the checkout stand because they have spent the whole time around the grocery store debating every item. Should I buy this? Should I buy this? Which price is better? What has a coupon? And so they're depleted by the time they get to the checkout stand and are more likely to throw extra stuff in the cart that they don't need. And when it comes to our life and our career and these big questions, either, you know, asking who am I, what's next, these big pivot questions can be draining. It can consume a lot of energy, more than a person might realize. Or conversely, if you're so bogged down just by the day to day, it's very hard to create space for the bigger pivot questions. And so it's just important to know, if you can create extra routines and even extra stability in your day to day, that will open up more bandwidth for thinking through the pivot questions. And you're going to need more than you might on a normal average day or right. week or year, depending what you're going through.
Right. And you said earlier a pivot can take, you know, it could literally take a few minutes. It could take months to complete. So let's just...
If not years.
Yes, yeah. So could we... I'm looking at the pivot quick method quick reference in the back of the book here. If we could run through this very quickly. Stage one is to plant. And I know you use the analogy of a basketball player, you know, grounding his foot before he turns. So talk to us about what that means.
Sure. Yeah. The basketball player, that's what really came to me of what I was doing wrong. I was kind of running around the basketball court like a crazy person. And it wasn't until, like the basketball player, so the first stage is plant. Get grounded. That the plant foot is a source of stability. And that's your existing assets, your strengths, your interests, what you're good at, what makes time fly, what's working best, and your one-year vision. What does success look like a year from now? Even if you don't know specifics, how do you want to feel? What's your ideal average day? What kind of impact do you want to have? Then your pivot foot can scan for people, skills, and projects that are related to what you've already identified. The biggest mistake most pivoters make is saying, I'm at a pivot point, what's out there? And they immediately start looking outside of themselves for answers. So scanning, the way to avoid analysis paralysis that you mentioned earlier is by rooting the scanning in what you uncover in the plant stage. And then pilot is about passing the ball around the court, looking for the best opportunity to launch or actually make a shot. And ideally, by the time you launch, you've reduced risk. So you can plant, scan, pilot over and over until you're ready to launch. And so that's where there's no set timeline. It's whenever you feel comfortable.
Mm-hmm. And then the stage five is lead.
Yeah, and then there's this kind of macro layer of using pivot as a coaching tool, a conversation framework. So whether you're managing employees or not, it's a way to guide a conversation that facilitates another person's own expertise. Rather than giving them the answers, how can you guide them through the stages of what's working, you know, what's exciting, and then helping them scan and pilot.
Right, right. So let's talk quickly about burnout, crash, recover. that cycle. Do you know that one?
Yes. Oh, yes. All too well. Yes.
And I know that you've experienced that. I've experienced that. I think probably most people have. How did you recover? How do you help your clients recover?
One thing I'll say is that I think a lot of times burnout comes from a good place. We're actually so engaged in our work and so committed to doing great work that we overdo it. And I know for myself, even when I'm fully aware that burnout is a possibility, like launching my book was a massive effort. It took 3 years of working on it. Even though I knew I did everything I could to have yoga, journaling, meditation, you know, easy weeks leading up to the launch, I still, 2 weeks after, the furry rest monster gobbled me up from the couch and swallowed me whole. That's what I said to my mailing list, that no matter what I did, I still was just wiped out at the end. And so I'll say give some self-compassion around. Burnout is often just because we have such drive. And then the thing to do is rest. And what I've noticed about burnout is we want to put a timeline on it. Like, okay, well then fine. You can take the weekend off. But we often need twice as long to actually rest than we want to give ourselves permission for.
Yes.
And so as uncomfortable as it is to sink into the void and rest and slow way the heck down, it's so critical and it's on its own timeline. And right. To let that be okay and to ask, what can I learn from this slower pace? And what's the cost if I don't? You know, if I don't make the changes, I've found in my experience, the physical signals just get louder and louder. So there's really no avoiding it either.
Right. It's very, very counterproductive not to take the time. But I do think that's something we have to learn ourselves quite often.
Yes. And yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I have to learn and relearn.
Yes, you know? Yes, yes.
Then we don't always see it coming. And yet injury or illness can be such an interesting teacher. And when it forces us to switch into a different mode. And so to just see it for, what can I learn from this? And why is this actually happening at the perfect time? And what am I meant to take from this? That's what I have found helps me make the most of burnout rather than just beat myself up for it.
Right. So we're almost at the end of our segment, Jenny. It goes so quickly. But I wonder if you could share with us some ways that we can become discoverable so that we don't have to go looking for opportunities. Some opportunities will find us.
I use the analogy of Bluetooth devices, that they both have to be discoverable in order to pair or connect to each other. And as you said, the most agile pivoters are not just good at looking for opportunities. Opportunities are coming to them. They have a wait list for clients. They are getting poached from one company to the next. And the three things that really facilitate that are results, reputation, and platform. Results, doing great work. Two, being known for it. And then three, ideally proactively putting that expertise out into the world, whether that's through writing, speaking, podcasting. Everybody's different. It's not that everybody needs to become an author or a social media celebrity. No, that would be exhausting. But how can you put yourself forward in your field as a recognized expert? We talked about our mutual friend, Dori Clark, who teaches great material on that front.
Right. Well, I think it's important to say that you say in the book, the most successful employees are skilled at creative thinking and innovating within their organizations. They're known as intrapreneurs. So this is not just for people who are looking to get out and work for themselves. This is for people who want to be successful wherever they are in life. Final quick thought you'd like to leave our listeners with, Jenny?
Learn to see fear and insecurity and uncertainty as doorways of opportunity. That if you're feeling anxious, we all are. The economy is changing quickly. It's okay. There's nothing wrong with you. And so my hope is that we can all stop taking our pivots so personally, like there's something wrong with us, and instead say, it's okay. And there's a new opportunity here. And what can I learn? How can I grow? And how can I make an impact? And that the big secret is we're pivoting more often than not. So if we can all just kind of get used to that, we can really make the most of it.
Well, I thank you for being with us today. I really enjoyed the book. There are bits that are really underlined a lot in here. So,
thank you.
The book is called Pivot, The Only Move That Matters is Your Next One. Jenny Blake, my guest. And Jenny, you've got several websites, so which is your preferred?
The best resource for all things we talked about is pivotmethod.com. There's coaching, community, and a bunch of free templates.
Awesome. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Vicky. Thanks for having me and everyone for listening.
Pleasure. And we will be back next week with an all-life news show. You can find me at 800-495-7617 if you have questions or comments on today's show, missed any of the information about how to contact our guests. You can reach out to me, 800-495-7617. You can also email me at info@conversationslive.net. And you'll find us on Facebook at Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair and Twitter at Vicky St. Clair. And that's it for us. Thanks for being with us. We appreciate you spending this hour with us, and we'll see you next week. Until then, live well, live strong.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.